The National Catholic Register is the essential and reliable source of news and views for Catholics. Subscribe today. Go to EWTN.com and click on the link for The Register or call 800-421-3230.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Tim Drake talks with EWTN's own Colin Donovan, our Vice President for Theology. You know, we're in the final week of Advent. How should we be observing the season prior to Christmas? Colin will shed some light on the season of Advent. And in the second half of our program, Tim will be talking with National Catholic Register columnist John Grondelsky about his recent column on the lessons of the Christmas classics, A Christmas Carol and It's a Wonderful Life. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Tim Drake, senior writer for the Register. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be with you.
And also with you, my friend. It hardly seems possible. Here we are. We are in the third week of Advent on the precipice of week number four. Seems like we just got out the Advent wreath and the candles.
Yes, it does, Tom. As I was thinking about Advent, can be for some of us a kind of a confusing season with all of the parties and the Christmas shopping and all of the preparations.
Yeah.
I think it's sometimes hard to prepare. And so it's hard to know just how to observe the season. And to help shed some light on the season of Advent, Colin Donovan, Vice President for Theology and moderator of the EWTN Theology Roundtable, is joining us. Colin, thanks for taking time to be with us on Register Radio today.
Oh, welcome, Tim. I'm very grateful for the opportunity and happy to do it.
So we all realize that the season of Advent is a time of waiting prior to Christmas. But why is it thought of as a penitential season? You know, when we think of penitential seasons, we think of Lent. Just shed some light on that for us.
Well, it actually goes back into the history of Advent. We don't have much information before the beginning of the 5th century, 400 or a little later. And at that time, as is somewhat still practiced in the Eastern churches where there's a greater degree of penitence generally prior to a feast, there was actually a 40-day fast before the Feast of Christmas. I think people have heard of the way St. Francis received the stigmata. It was while making a fast in preparation for the feast of the Archangel Michael. So this idea of a preparatory fast before a great feast is something that was quite present in the early church, both East and West, and has become a little bit truncated in the West, at least with respect to Christmas. The lengthy fast from the period of the early church shortened to a four-week period of preparation, so that Advent has acquired the nickname the Little Lent as opposed to the Greater Lent before Easter. So a penitential element has remained with Advent based on its origins, but it's much more reduced than we associate with the period of preparation for the great Paschal mysteries of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter, of course.
Certainly. And with the idea of fasting during Advent, I think for some people that might strike them as strange, but I do know some individuals and families who actually try to refrain from attending parties prior to Christmas. I'm just wondering if there are particular ways that you would recommend that people observe Advent.
Again, with the idea which the church has today of it as a little Lent, there's no necessity to go overboard in terms of penitential practices. One is free to do that, however. I'm not saying that one can't do that. But I think, for instance, in the question of parties, there is sort of a moderate or middle point there between a charity for those who have invited you as well as perhaps a little restrained also, and I think you can combine those two in the context of a party. I know Mother Angelica, when she was still our chairman and still active here at the network, established the practice of both the Advent retreat, which we have at the beginning of Advent, as well as a Christmas luncheon for the employees around the time of the period of incorporation of the network, which is actually the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so that's a combining of the two, recognizing it is penitential, but that doesn't mean that we don't look forward to Christmas, that we're not celebrating the coming of the Lord. And sometimes charity obliges us to an office party or a family party or something like that, and we can still exercise restraint in that context, you know, without offending the host and without appearing as better than thou and that kind of thing.
Sure, and I want to remind listeners you are listening to Register Radio. I am Tim Drake, and we are talking with Colin Donovan, who is Vice President for Theology at EWTN. We're talking about Advent. Colin, another practice during Advent is the singing of the O Antiphons. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what they are and the importance of them.
Again, sort of going back to the way Advent is constructed, the first part of Advent, where a lot of the readings are dealing with the second coming of the Lord. So there's an element of penitence there for us to think of, you know, our sins and before when the Lord comes, whether for us personally at the hour of our death or for the world at the end of history, when the Lord returns, there will be, you know, a certain amount of wailing and gnashing of teeth over sins. And so there's a certain penitential element. The O Antiphons are six titles of the Lord. I have them written down here. O Wisdom, O Leader of the House of Israel, O Flower of Jesse's Stem, O Key of David, O Emmanuel, O King of all nations, O Radiant Dawn, or Orient, as it would be in the Latin. These are prophetic titles of the Lord, and so between the 17th and the 24th of December, the Church uses them at the Gospel Acclamation and also in Vespers of the Liturgy of the Hours for the Antiphons. And so it's a way of putting our attention on Christmas, which is imminent. It's a way of recalling the prophetic element that prepared the way of the Lord, as John the Baptist did. And so the O Antiphons, or the Great O's, as they're sometimes called, is one thing that the Church has built into her liturgical practice in order to focus us then on Christmas and tie it to the Old Covenant and the prophetic material of the Old Covenant.
Sure. I had read somewhere that the usage of the O Antiphons was so prevalent in monasteries that the phrase, keep your O, was a common phrase used, which I had never heard before.
Well, that's certainly true, because remember, especially in Benedictine monasteries, where I had the great privilege of doing my undergraduate theology work, the singing of the chanting of the psalms, the chanting of the office is very important. And so you can have an elaborate Gregorian chant. In fact, for Vespers and sung Gregorian chant, this is a great occasion, the singing of the O Antiphons.
Very good. And most recently, as you had said, we celebrated the third Sunday of Advent, otherwise known as Gaudete Sunday. It's the time when the rose-colored candle is lit, the priest is able to wear rose-colored vestments, some churches celebrate it with additional singing. What is it that makes this particular Sunday during Advent so set apart?
Well, again, it goes back to the original practice of Advent, when, like Lent, which has Laetare Sunday right in the middle to sort of break up Lent and bring a little joy and festivity into it, Gaudete Sunday was in the middle of the ancient 40-day Advent. So now that we have a four-week Advent, it's still right in the middle. It's halfway. It's 2 weeks in. And again, we're beginning to turn our attention to Christmas. We're taking a little bit more of a joyful stance toward the season as we anticipate the first coming of our Lord. And so this is an occasion to sort of back away from the penitential idea. Rose is a moderation of purple. It's brighter, it's more colorful, it's more joyful, to add the organ back, perhaps to accompany the singing, which is recommended be left off during Advent, to do that on that day, and those kinds of practices.
Very good. We are speaking with Colin Donovan, Vice President for Theology at EWTN, and we're talking about the season of Advent. In addition to the practice of lighting Advent candles and having Advent wreaths, what are some other practices that are common during Advent? I know that some families will utilize a Jesse tree to prepare for Christmas's coming. What are some other practices that are typical for this season?
Well, the Jesse tree, I think, is certainly one that is a specifically religious and traditional one, adding the different symbols on the tree representing the prophetic figures of the Old Testament who were anticipations of Christ in some way, Moses, Jesse, Joseph, and so on. And so that certainly something could be done. People can also progressively build the manger. Of course, the tradition of the church is that Jesus is not the manger, and some of the ancillary characters, the shepherds and that, are put out before Christmas. And ultimately, maybe in the last few days, Mary and Joseph, and then finally on Christmas itself, Jesus is put in the manger. So you could progressively build the manger. There's also calendars where you can sort of build the characters of Christmas and do something on each day with a prayer. The hymn, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, is essentially the O antiphons. So to sing that, and each day add the O of that day so that the song gets a little bit longer each day. And finally, to put up the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve rather than at the beginning of December, as our secular world is promoting. My wife noted that there's no Christmas stuff in the stores anymore. It's all gone. It's like Christmas is over. And in reality, Christmas begins with Christmas Eve, to put up the tree, to decorate it, and to keep it up either till the baptism of the Lord on January 9th, or the more traditional practice, even to the presentation of the Lord in February 2nd. So unlike the world, unlike the stores, we should be practicing Christmas and the celebration of it beginning with Christmas Eve and not with Halloween or an earlier date when the stores find it convenient to promote their Christmas items.
My wife is going to be a big fan of yours, Colin. She and her family always put the tree up on Christmas Eve. And as a former Lutheran, I always want to get the tree up a little earlier than that. It just seems like too much activity for Christmas Eve.
Well, I think we have to be countercultural, and sadly our culture is influenced, I think, perhaps by the many aliturgical Protestant churches that don't have a sense of a liturgical year and season, and that has set the ground for a fully secularized understanding of Christmas. And so in our country, unlike in Italy and Rome, for instance, we sort of have the order of celebration inverted.
I want to thank you. This has been very informative, Colin, and I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us on Register Radio, and also want to wish you and your family a blessed Christmas.
And also, Tim, you and your family, and to all our listeners as well.
Always appreciate hearing from Colin Donovan, who is also the host of Open Line Friday here on EWTN Radio. I'm right there with you both. We in our family, the Price family, we always put up the tree on Gaudete Sunday and take it down on January 9th. So I guess that's the grand compromise there. When we return, can we learn something from pop culture? Well, I think when you're talking about a movie like It's a Wonderful Life, we certainly think so. John Grondelsky will be breaking it down for us in just 60 seconds. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
Are you concerned about the way our nation and our world are heading? Are you looking for the truth behind the issues of the day? Do you need support in standing up for life, the family, and our Catholic faith? Then join well-informed Catholics worldwide who depend on the National Catholic Register to address the most compelling questions of our time. Now part of the EWTN family of services, the Register is a trusted source of news and views with an unwavering fidelity to the Pope and the Magisterium. Get the in-depth analysis you need explaining what happened and why it matters for Catholics who engage in the culture to serve Christ. To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner, or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And we welcome you back. Along with Tim Drake, I'm Tom Price. And Tim, we're very excited to be adding a new show to our EWTN Radio Advent and Christmas lineup. It's a wonderful dramatization of A Christmas Carol. That's going to be airing on the EWTN radio Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern and again at 10 p.m. Eastern. And you know, when we look at a movie or a story like A Christmas Carol, we usually look at a movie or a story for entertainment, but there are some great life lessons to be learned from a story like Christmas Carol or a movie like It's a Wonderful Life. And we're very blessed to have John Grondelsky with us to connect the dots today.
That's right, Tom. These are two of my favorite stories. And John Grondelsky recently wrote a timely column for the National Catholic Register on the lessons of the Christmas classics, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and Frank Capra's film It's a Wonderful Life. John Grondelsky is the former Associate Dean of the School of Theology at Seton Hall University. He holds a doctorate in moral theology. He lives in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, with his wife and three children. John, thanks so much for joining us today on Register Radio.
Thank you, Tim. I'm glad to be here and glad to talk about both the Christmas Carol and the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, you recently wrote a great article for the National Catholic Register, which listeners can find on the website and in the print edition. And in your article, you suggest that although both of these are thought of as Christmas stories, they really carry a message for all seasons. And what message is that?
Well, Tim, there's lots of messages that we can find in It's a Christmas Carol and It's a Wonderful Life, messages that are valid all year round. Messages like people are more important than things, that love matters most of all, that choices have consequences, that truth can't be evaded, that feelings require action, that man is social, and that death puts things in perspective. But today, I think, particularly in the Christmas season, we should talk about the value of each human person. That's the message of Christmas, but not only the message of Christmas. Once upon a time, Cardinal Wyszyński, the primate of Poland, described Christmas as the feast of God in diapers. And that's a message year-round, that if God was willing to be, the creator of the universe is willing to become human enough to wear human diapers, then how important the human person is. When we look at the pontificate of Blessed John Paul II, that's what his pontificate is about, to create a Christian humanism, to talk about how important each person is, made in the image and likeness of God. And that's a concept and an idea that's been so terribly forgotten and so terribly violated in the 20th century. So it's something we need to bring forth straight center, the value of each human person.
Yeah, John, and that certainly is a message that is opposed to kind of the modern philosophy of a quality of life ethic, which decides that some lives aren't worth living, which, interestingly, is the very philosophy espoused by Scrooge early on in A Christmas Carol, isn't it?
It is. It's also the message that is the catalyst for George Bailey's downward swing at the end of the film, when he finds out that he's on the hook for $8,000, he goes to Potter asking for help. And Potter, who in fact has stolen the money from him essentially, looks at his life insurance policy and tells him, you're worth more dead than alive. So in both cases, in Scrooge's case, in Potter's case, they have a quality of life ethic. And maybe it's not because they wanted to set out that way, but, you know, St. Thomas tells us that when we that human beings always try to act according to the good. Sometimes the good is real, sometimes the good is imaginary, but people act by what they think is the good. But when we choose the wrong good, when we select a false good, then it turns our whole moral life, our whole moral compass upside down. When we start treating north as south and south as north, everything's going to be put a kilter. And that's what happens to Scrooge. That's what happens to Mr. Potter. Their moral world is topsy-turvy. And, you know, John Paul, again, talked about this way back before he was Pope, something he called resentment when he talked about chastity, that we sometimes pick values and you know, turn our moral world inside out. It's not just Scrooge. Our world today turns values inside out. We call evil things rights that should be defended, that should even be promoted internationally, while at the same time real rights like the right to life are trampled underfoot, are ignored, are denied.
Want to remind listeners, we are speaking with John Grundulski, a columnist with the National Catholic Register, and we are talking about the Christmas classics, A Christmas Carol and It's a Wonderful Life. What's also interesting, I think, is that both stories are pro-life not only in their message, but that in the stories themselves, it's actually a child who brings about the conversion, right?
Yes, very true. It's children themselves that bring about that conversion. I mean, obviously, in the case of the Christmas Carol, it's Tiny Tim. In the case of It's a Wonderful Life, it's George Bailey's family. When, you know, George Bailey is looking for Zuzu's petals in his pocket, I mean, this is his connection to why he wants to live. But it's not only those two. I mean, if you look at the Christmas Carol, for example, when the ghost of Christmas past takes Scrooge into his youth and he now sees his old girlfriend who is now married to somebody else, who the children gather around her for Christmas Eve, the first thing that Dickens says about that is, you know, and Scrooge thought, these could have been my children. In some sense, his nephew Fred is a kid because he's got that lively Christmas feeling to him and he wants to invite his uncle. Conversely, to what degree is Scrooge's father responsible for the kind of guy that Ebenezer Scrooge has become because he shunted him off, because he sent him off to the boarding school, because he ignored him? Same thing in It's a Wonderful Life. The only family guy in It's a Wonderful Life is George Bailey. He's the one with family, he's the one with children, he's the really developed character. Just as he comes from a real family where we meet his mother, his father, his brother Harry. You know, the psychologist Eric Erickson once upon a time talked about stages of human development, one of which is generativity, being responsible for the next generation. By taking responsibility for those whose lives, in a sense, have depended on you, makes someone grow, makes someone develop. And in our world today, particularly with its contraceptive mentality, that's a value that's being progressively lost.
On a lighter note, I want to ask you, John, do you have a favorite version of A Christmas Carol? Is there one that you like over the others?
Oh, I do. I do. About the middle of the 1980s, George C. Scott played It's a Wonderful Life. Played a Christmas Carol, played the role of Scrooge. Mm-hmm. And that shows up every now and then on television. It's available for video purchase. The reason I like that is because often the Christmas Carol gets reduced to being a kind of kid's story. You know, we've got ghosts running around at Christmas time, etc. But as we're trying to say here, the message of the Christmas Carol is also a very adult message. And the way that George C. Scott plays it, I think, is good. He portrays it as an adult. It's set in a real historical context. It's very faithful to Dickens's original text. And we see in the way Scott plays that Scrooge's main problem is not his greed, as much as it's his pride, his arrogance, that people are dispensable for him, that he doesn't care until, you know, he finally confronts his own mortality. I think that's a particularly good version. I would also point out there was a author by the name of Michael Hearn who wrote a fantastic book called The Annotated Christmas Carol, where you can find out all the allusions and all the references that Dickens made, and it really makes it a story that becomes more than just, you know, a kid's Christmas ghost story.
Well, very good. And it's interesting when it comes to converting public opinion on issues, and I was thinking of slavery and how the abolitionists in England sought to use art, poetry, song, literature, and then Dickens in A Christmas Carol was arguing against the prevalent thinking about the poor at his time. It seems that we really do need some modern stories that reaffirm the culture of life ethic, don't we?
Oh, we very much need those. I mean, when Dickens says, for example, when he puts in the mouth of Scrooge that, are there no workhouses for the poor? Where are the treadmills? This is almost a direct quote out of Thomas Malthus, the intellectual granddaddy of zero population growth. And that quote was almost 50 years old at the time that Dickens wrote his book. So he clearly is engaging his culture, and we do need those kinds of things today. You know, I think of a movie like Bella, which has a pro-life angle to it. I think about a series that was popular about 20 years ago on television about a young man with Down syndrome. And we don't see enough of those kinds of people in art and television. We need to, you know, make present in culture and in literature and in art and in television all sorts of human beings, because we're not going to build a culture of life until we, in fact, build a culture. It's important that we change the law. It's important that we address issues such as the protection of the right to life. But in any event, we're not going to be able to do that until we build a culture. And we build a culture on a variety of levels. That includes entertainment. That includes profit. I mean, you know, The Christmas Carol started out as, you know, a Christmas book in an age that Dickens wanted to make money. He was selling these year after year for about 10 years in the 1840s. But the abiding message is there. It's good art, but it's good art with a message.
Well, thank you so much, John, for joining us on Register Radio. We appreciate your perspective, and I want to wish you and your family a blessed Christmas.
And the same to you, Tim, and to all our listeners.
Thank you also from me, John, and I want to remind all of our listeners, we'll have that wonderful rendition of A Christmas Carol here on EWTN Radio Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern and 10 p.m. Eastern. Of course, if you want to check out John Grundelsky's wonderful blog on this, you can go to ncregister.com. Tim, my friend, we will talk again next week just before Christmas Eve. May your remaining days of Advent be very peaceful, my friend.
And yours as well, Tom.
Thank you. And next week on Register Radio, Tim talks with National Catholic Register film critic Stephen Gray Donis about an essay that Stephen wrote about broken family films. Also, Dan Burke will be here. He'll talk with National Catholic Register blogger Matthew Warner about Catholics and new media. And thank you for joining us on Register Radio. For Tim and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With your donations to the National Catholic Register, you will play an active role in clarifying the Church's views. Visit ncregister.com and click on the Donate tab or call 205-568-9756.